Lecture 8, The Stoic Idea of Natural Law.
In his work, The Republic, the Roman statesman Cicero provides the first really thoroughgoing treatise on natural law as such, where the term is used and where we have both the components of a naturally based system of ethics and a sense that this is to be handled in terms of the category of law. But much of Cicero's work is dependent upon various Greek Stoics. And so I'd like to devote this lecture to some of that Stoicism, which articulated ideas which are crucial for Cicero, and then to Cicero himself and some of his ideas. The Stoics are both Greek and Roman, and they have some very interesting ideas. And then when we turn to Cicero toward the end of this lecture, we'll consider three of his works in which the idea comes out so clearly. The Stoics are a movement that begins in Greece after the time of Plato and Aristotle. We could date it perhaps to the philosopher Zeno around the year 300. And Zeno and his followers championed a notion of self-reliance, which was very, very strong. And in fact, the very notion of Stoicism as present today, I think, emphasizes that self-reliance, that grittiness that we have and a willingness to face pain and face difficulty with a stiff upper lip. But it's a characterization in the modern period which certainly has its justification from the way the ancient Stoics conceived the proper form of life. In addition to that general approach to life, what I'm interested in talking about with you today is their strong sense of right reason and right reasoning according to nature, for this is the contribution they make to natural law theory. The Stoics generally tend to be materialist, that is, they're very, very suspicious of any of these immaterial notions, such as Plato had championed with his notion of the soul, and yet they are extremely high-minded and have no difficulty talking about high-minded ideals like justice and even including God in their system. Zeno, for instance, at one point urges that right reason is something which, he says, pervades all things and is identical with Zeus, the Lord and ruler of everything that exists. Now, in articulating that notion of right reason that is identical, equivalent to Zeus, he is trying to bring together that long Greek tradition of thinking about God as the origin and source of the universe with the long traditions in Greece of thinking about human culture and arranging for a politics which will promote the virtues and the good living possible in rightly ordered culture. Notice even in that sentence that I just quoted that he has got there a connection between two ideas which are extremely important in the whole history of natural law. The first idea is the idea of right reason. It's a sense that reason can operate rightly or wrongly. Reason will operate rightly when it's discerning the truth about things, and then when it's figuring out how matters that are open to our choice can be selected well so that we will achieve a kind of a harmony. It's not just a matter of purely instrumental reasoning. It's not just a matter of figuring out how to make out of everything else a tool to get to our end, but a sense of right reasoning, a sense of conforming ourselves to a basic pattern and to a goal that is built within us. And he identifies this as equivalent to the notion of Zeus ruling over as Lord and ruler, ruling over everything that exists. He is not one much for mythology, but rather he takes this name of Zeus to be the very incarnation of what justice is. We see this continue in subsequent Stoics. We could mention, for instance, Chrysippus, who lives later in the 3rd century B.C. To quote from Chrysippus, "For all beings, which are social by nature, the natural law directs what must be done and forbids what must not be done." Now here, too, we see not only the usage of the language of natural law, but we see that strong sense of our human association with various kinds of animals. Not all animals are gregarious, not all animals are social, but some animals are. And Chrysippus, in line with Zeno before him, thought of our natural law as something that we share with lots of animals, that animals which are naturally social, animals which live in herds, animals which stand together for common purposes, will have a natural law directing them if they are going to cooperate on the hunt, if they are going to cooperate living peacefully together. There must be something within them that inclines them to this harmonious way of life. And so he suggests that while for most animals it's going to be a matter of a spontaneous inclination, a natural directedness, for us it's going to be a matter of right reasoning about this, following out our inclinations toward living together, feeling a friendship with one another, feeling inclined to one another, but figuring out how to do this so as to promote the harmony in matters of choice. This raises for the Stoics the question about whether civic orders should be promoted or whether one should be those staunchly defended personal Stoics, that sense of self-reliance above all. And while the Stoics cultivate self-reliance, they are also extremely strong in urging civic devotion. Panaetius, a later Stoic, for instance, argues that our social institutions are quite thoroughly natural and that they are never based on merely self-interest, but always have to be concerned with the common good. And he takes up many of Aristotle's argument for natural justice, claiming, and here we see it originating in the Stoics in a way that we did not see it originating in Aristotle, the claim that all human beings possess the same basic capacity to participate with this reasoning and a fundamental equality and universal kinship among all human beings. To sum up, then, the Stoics find themselves strongly urging self-reliance. This is the key to virtue, but strongly seeing self-reliance as a suitable subject for promoting the common good, that if everyone is self-reliant, and in particular, if the whole society is devised in such a way as to promote that self-reliance, there can be a common happiness. There can be a real harmony in the human community like there is a harmony in nature. The second point of emphasis with the Stoics is that they connect this idea of moral obligation, this sense of right reasoning, with God. And here, too, it's worthwhile for us to review for a minute what the Stoics have contributed to this discussion. As I was trying to paint the story of the understanding of God that the various pre-Socratics, Socrates, and Plato had suggested, increasingly it was an abstract vision of God, that Thales and Anaximenes, Anaximander, Heraclitus, Parmenides, all of the pre-Socratics tried to get away from those mythological gods of the ancient world, charming gods and goddesses who were often acting in ways that we humans would consider naughty. In the course of seeking a first principle, a philosophical explanation, what they tended to do was to treat that first principle as a deity, to treat it as the source and origin for all of physical nature, for all of organic nature, for all of humankind, and yet they made it increasingly impersonal, precisely in order to get away from the vagaries of human willfulness. Because those charming gods and goddesses of Greek mythology were so willful and sometimes so extremely jealous and doing things which seemed to offend against morality, this strong sense of natural morality led the early Greek thinkers to a notion that the first principle, the deity, and they did recognize a deity, had to be an impersonal deity. One sees this in Plato when we were considering the Republic. The chief idea is the idea of the good, and there are various other perfect forms, like equality, or the perfect form of human nature, or the form of beauty. And all of these forms and these ideas stand superior to the God who is busy creating the world, that the God has to be a good, reliable craftsman, but he's not truly in charge. Aristotle, too, is a religious man and has a notion of God, but his God is the God who is pure mind, mind thinking itself. And Aristotle's God is not a creator devising plans for the world. Aristotle's God thinks only of himself. Nothing else is quite worthy, but everything else is moved by a kind of attraction to the God. They are, I think, perplexed by willfulness, and to a certain degree their theories are influenced by this notion that God has to be so perfect that we can't have God in any way willful or in any way subjective. And that our morality has to respect that. Our morality has to concern itself with nature, with that which we do not create, control, or alter, but that which we can discover as an eternal essence, as an unchanging, immutable structure or form. What we see in the Stoics is a different picture. We are now again seeing the language of God, and God spoken up by a personal name, Zeus, in a way that Plato and Aristotle never did. And it is this move back to a personal God that is within the Stoic system that does two things to their ethics. First thing it does to the ethics is now to let ethics be considered in terms of law rather than in terms of purely virtue. The Stoics still have virtues, and they got lots of them, but now there is another category, and law can be an all-embracing category for considering ethics in a way that it never quite amounted to be the right category in Plato or Aristotle. The Stoics do that. Secondly, the Stoics open up this dimension of personality in a way that we do not, frankly, see it opened up with Plato or Aristotle, that even though they are preparing the way by emphasizing nature, their sense is that politics is more important than ethics, and that individual morality is something that is in service of political morality, that the individual good must always yield to the higher common good. Granted that important theme, what the Stoics managed to bring out by focusing in on individual self-reliance and by focusing on this role of God in ethics is that there's opening a way for the development that will be very fruitful in the course of natural law history, the importance of person that will come when we see the development of that very notion of person in Christian culture, and a role for God as lawgiver, which Christians will borrow heavily from the Stoics when they have a chance to read and consider their matter. But that's jumping ahead of the story a little bit. We were reviewing the history of these Stoics for the sake of the contribution they make to Cicero, because Cicero, that Roman statesman of the first century, uses these Stoic ideas for his own purposes in Roman culture. Cicero was a statesman who was also a philosopher, and both during the time of his greatest activity, as well as on those periods of his life when he was in more philosophical retreat, he liked nothing better than to try to put the ideas about the common good, about the political order, into thoroughgoing philosophical form. We owe tremendous debt to Cicero for the communication of Greek ideas into the Latin-speaking world. In particular, I'd like to speak about three of Cicero's works. The first is his book De Republica, translated as The Republic, or sometimes as On the Commonwealth, from around 54 to 51 BC. In this book, we see him very directly borrowing from the Stoics on the connection between law and reason that will be central to natural law theory. For example, in Book 3, Chapter 22, he says, "There is a true law, right reason in accord with nature. It is of universal application, unchanging and everlasting. It is wrong to abrogate this law, and it cannot be annulled. There is one law, eternal and unchangeable, binding at all times upon all peoples. And there will be, as it were, one common master and ruler of men, God, who is the author of this law and its interpreter and sponsor." Now, this passage of Cicero enunciates what will be main themes for natural law theory in the course of the rest of its history. This association between nature and right reason, we saw him picking that up from the Stoics, with this concentration on reason, not merely as instrumental, not merely as figuring out how to get where we want to go, but reason as discerning, reason as extremely receptive, reason as trying to be open so as to understand the truth about our natures and how those natures ought to develop. But secondly, we see Cicero in this passage talking about reason as linked to law, that what reason must especially discern, that what reason must especially appreciate and be open to, is a moral obligation that is of divine origin. If anything, I think we see something that goes back to, say, the insight of Antigone in the play by Sophocles, where she has a sense that there is a God who is behind all this, that there is a God who has devised all these things, set them up, and that what we must do is to appreciate this divine law if we intend to have personal harmony and political harmony. But likewise, in that same passage that I just read, we also hear some of the other themes that natural law theory will make in its claims about the nature of this moral law. It says, "It is wrong ever to abrogate it, and it cannot be annulled." A sense that even when we do devise situations that are otherwise, the law will come back to haunt us, that there will be a kind of a natural law sanction. One sees this, for instance, in something like drug abuse in the modern day, namely that one can override what is really and truly good for our bodies, but there will be effects and a kind of a natural sanction or punishment, that no matter how we may try by our wills to make it otherwise, there is invariably something that is a law that we must respect and that we cannot but help but experience if we should violate it. He also says, in the middle of the passage, there is one law, eternal and unchangeable, binding at all times upon all peoples. This is that tremendous Stoic appreciation for the universal fraternity of all human beings, a fundamental equality among them all because of their common nature. And it's a strong sense that a kind of a corrective to that Aristotelian sense of natural hierarchy in which there can even be natural slaves. Curiously, though, there is a kind of a blindness in Cicero, for even though he has such strong statements about universal equality, he also tolerates slaves. It takes an enormous effort of the mind, I think, to see the full implications of some of the principles that they're able to enunciate so clearly. Although Cicero does not articulate the details of the natural law in the course of his book, The Republic, he does mention a few of them that are worth noting here for the influence that they will have in subsequent generations of natural law thinkers. He makes it clear in that third book that there are various duties of natural justice, that we must respect the lives and the property of others, and that we have obligations to contribute to society. Now, I mention in particular the respecting the lives and the properties of others. And I do so because he sees this as an insight about the nature of law and the nature of morality, which stands as a corrective to any theory of human nature which puts human nature largely in terms of power. When one is asking, as Callicles or as Thrasymachus did in the course of our review of Plato, aren't some people just naturally stronger? And if they're naturally stronger or naturally more clever, well, why shouldn't they have rule over those who are naturally weaker? Cicero's entire and complete conviction is that the analysis of our nature will give a corrective to this incentive to use stronger power merely at our whim or merely at our will, and that there is an obligation on all part to respect the lives and property of others. Later on in the history of our review of natural law thinking and the history of ethics, we'll see this articulated as the notion of right. We say, for instance, from our American Declaration of Independence, that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Or, in the language of John Locke, from which so much of the Declaration is borrowed, a right to life, liberty, and property. That language of rights is of much later derivation. We do not find these ancient thinkers talking in terms of rights. What we find them talking is in terms of duties. That is, we have various obligations because of nature. Now, rights and duties are always correlative. It's more a matter of whether the given author in question, at a given period in history, finds a term, finds a way to express this correlation. In these ancient figures, the emphasis is far more on duty. And the very word right that is sometimes used, jus, it's sort of the basis of our terminology about jurisdiction or jurisprudence, that initial phrase, comes from a notion of right in antiquity, which Cicero is strong on, but it's more that which it is right or correct for us to do. And the very notion of law in antiquity can be spoken about in terms of the term jus, juris, that is, this term which is the basis of jurisprudence, or in the terms of lex, which is the origin of our word legislation, legislature. Both of those terms suggest a law, whether it's a law we create, as in the word lex, or a law in which we are focusing on what is already right, and that's when we're speaking of jus, in the sense of a jurist or jurisprudence. Cicero is very, very strong on seeing our obligations, seeing our duties to respect the lives and properties of others and to contribute to society, and his strong sense of our duties in this respect will be enormously important for later articulations of rights in the sense that we use the word in modern day. Also in Book 3 of his book, The Republic, we see in Chapter 23 references to just and unjust war, And that's something which I think is very rare in antiquity. There was a sense that war was something that was hateful, something that we had to do. But war, I think, tended to be envisioned largely in terms of power. But with Cicero, war, too, is here being brought under moral circumspection. He says in chapter 23 that there is a difference between just and unjust war. And in response to the charge that states are simply the result of force and conquest, sort of a realpolitik in the ancient world, Cicero argues that Rome has been much more careful, that Rome has waged wars only to repel invaders or to restore justice. Now, that may be overlooking a few of the wars that Rome actually conducted, but at least in theory, Cicero is articulating a standard which he, as a statesman, felt the need to try to apply. And he insists that for war to be justified, it has to be formally declared, and that it may never be waged until an explicit demand has been issued for the redress of the grievances experienced. Unless that formal demand has been made and rejected, one may not go to war. This, I think, may be Cicero the statesman trying to shape Roman policy, trying to inculcate a pattern of high virtue in Rome's political and military decisions. But he articulates it on the basis of this same approach to natural justice, which he borrows from the Stoics under the heading of natural law. A second book by Cicero, at which we should look for a few minutes, is his book De Officiis, translated On Moral Duties, which he writes about the year 44 BC. Here, the focus is on personal ethics to a much greater degree, and Cicero is busy stressing the duties that we have to one another by virtue of being human and being social in our humanity, by invariably needing to live in one or another form of society. His stress throughout this book, De Officiis, is on the fact that we may not conduct our lives purely on the basis of self-interest, but always must be looking out for the other is another self. In Book 3 of De Officiis, he says at Chapter 5 the following: "To take away wrongfully from another, and for one man to advance his own interest by the disadvantage of another man, is more contrary to nature than death, than poverty, than pain, than any other evil." Now, one sees in a sentence like that certainly some rhetorical appeal to a sense of nobility and to a sense of honor. I would urge us to consider it, especially in light of the Stoicism to which Cicero was so deeply devoted and to which he was so deeply indebted. The Stoics, that Cicero so much loved, had a strong sense of the need to make a very rigorous distinction between what we can control and what we cannot. They would urge us to make a strong dividing line and to put on one side of that line anything that really is in our control, and on the other side of that line, anything that is outside of our control. When you start to make that distinction and that division, well, what is truly outside of our control? Well, the economy is outside of our control. We can have certain influence upon it by the decisions we make, but a lot of it's outside of our control. Our health is ultimately outside of our control. Maybe not immediately, for we're able to have a good diet and do good exercise, be restrained and temperate in our intake. But nonetheless, diseases can come and afflictions can come, and certainly our what we've received by genetic inheritance is outside of our control. How about the honor that we have? Well, yes, there's a little bit that's in our control. If we act honorably, we would expect to be treated honorably. And yet I think we all know that even when we have acted most honorably, it is quite possible for people, even when they've acted honorably, to be sabotaged, for calumnies to be asserted, and for things to be said that damage reputation, which it is extremely hard to defend oneself against. For all these things, Cicero urges in this book, De Officiis, he urges that we have that Stoic self-reliance, and that with anything that's on the side of being outside of our control, what we have to do is cultivate a kind of indifference. We can't let ourselves be determined by what other people think or by anything that we cannot thoroughly and completely control. Instead, what we must do is to take note of what's inside our control and focus on that, because only there are we the true masters and do we have that sort of self-mastery that is so typically associated with virtue. But what is it that ultimately is in our control perfectly? And he, like the other Stoics, would insist the only thing that is perfectly in our control is our choices, is our decisions about how we act and about how we feel. That we can choose to repress a feeling, we can choose to transcend a feeling, that we can choose to act or not to act. We can choose to act honorably, even if others will mistreat us for that. We can choose to act honorably, even in situations that are extremely dangerous or overwhelming. Here in this book, he urges that strong Stoic sense of self-control, and if I may read the passage again, we'll see his sense of why this is the highest thing our nature is capable of. He says, "To take away wrongfully from another, and for one man to advance his own interest by the disadvantage of another man," he says, "is more contrary to nature than death, poverty, pain, or any other evil." Now, to say that and to mean it requires that Stoic self-reliance, namely that the most noble part of ourselves is that which is within our own self-control. And to do that and to cultivate honor, he thinks, is natural, is fulfilling the highest part of our nature, where to act dishonorably would to act against that which is most important to us because that which is most human in us. Cicero, of course, in his focus on self-reliance, is still the statesman. And in the course of this same book on duties, he has enormous praise for public service and enormous praise for political participation. I personally suspect that the Roman Empire, which was just at this point beginning to take shape at the end of the Roman Republic, Cicero lived in the days of the Republic, the Roman Empire was capable of such great civic things, was capable of achievements around the world, precisely because so many of Roman statesmen, Roman administrators, and Roman bureaucrats shared some of Cicero's ideas, this sense of doing what is good, what is for the common good, even if there will be some personal disadvantage, some personal sacrifice that is required, even if it will take me away from beloved Rome and out into the provinces for years, I can find ways that will be truly honorable and will build up the human community and will make it possible for others also to rise to the best of their nature. Later on, when Augustine is writing his own book, The City of God, and commenting upon Cicero, he has nothing but praise for Cicero, even though he thinks that there is something the matter with the Ciceronian Republic, namely, that it doesn't seem designed to give praise and honor to the true God. Augustine nonetheless finds in Cicero something which is so high-minded and so virtuous, precisely because of this concentration upon that which is best in human nature, and not best in terms of mere self-interest, but best in terms of the common good, focusing on patterns of institutional living which will provide others that same opportunity for real integrity. In a third work by Cicero, the book called De Legibus, or On the Laws, which comes from 43 BC, shortly before Cicero's death, one finds Cicero articulating another important Stoic notion that I called attention to at the beginning of this lecture, namely, the moral equality of all human beings on the basis of their common nature. This is a fundamental insight which natural law theories will never depart from, and while we have earlier anticipations of it, with Cicero we have a very clear and explicit teaching. And yet I notice, cannot help but notice, that cultural blindness can still remain, for just several chapters later, after he has enunciated this wonderful phrase about the common moral equality of all on the basis of their nature, Cicero lapses into a defense of the institution of slavery. One finds it very, very hard to understand, except that sometimes we do not see the implications of the principles that we have enunciated. And yet, earlier on in his book, he gave one of those principles that I am so delighted and want to share with you. Book 1, Chapter 10. No single being is so like another as all of us are to one another. Reason, which alone raises us above the level of the beasts, is certainly common to us all, and though varying in what it learns, at least in the capacity to learn, it is invariable. This is Cicero, I think, at his best, not when he is justifying the institution of slavery, but when he is trying to think about that common human nature. As our lectures proceed from here, I'm going to be making a diversion in the next two lectures to another tradition that is important, namely to the biblical tradition in which we start thinking in terms of creator and of creatures and how this plays out for morality. And then I'll consider early Christian teaching in the period that is called the patristic period. But in the lecture after that, I will return to these Stoic ideas and the Ciceronian ideas as they enter into the realm of law and as we have the grand synthesis beginning to emerge, the tradition of nature from classical antiquity, the tradition of creature from biblical history, focused in now on this notion of natural law as devised by a creator of our natures in the way that the God known to Judaism and Christianity can serve as this creator of our natures and founder of natural law.